If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Let's get your take on the jobs numbers. That's top of mind. What are you thinking about, Elise?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Earlier in the week, ADP said that we saw a growth of jobs, about 145,000, and that was less than expected. And yet, as usual, ADP is a little bit low. Job growth numbers totaled 236,000 in March. That was about what economists had expected. But overall, the hiring pace had slowed. But if you look at how jobs are doing compared with pre-pandemic levels, we're still above what that average was. And I know that that's probably concerning to somebody like David, as you had said, because that just means to him that the Fed is going to keep raising interest rates, which means mortgage rates are going up, which means fewer mortgages and fewer homes sold. But yeah. In general, it feels to me like we're heading towards a softer landing, and that's better than a deep, dark recession.
Talk to me about a couple of other things. The story about the Uber CEO. What is that story? That was in the Journal, right?
It was in the Wall Street Journal this morning. And I got to tell you, I love when they do a dive like this. And I love when a CEO of a company like Uber, which has completely changed the way we do almost everything in this country, right? I mean, the way that we used to order a cab and raise our hands and hail it, and now we don't do that. We just go to our phones and we, you know, pop open an app and instantly, magically, the cab comes. But what he did is when they were in the pandemic and they saw that they were losing drivers, when people started, that was fine when nobody wanted to use an Uber, but when people started to come back, they needed to find a way to keep their drivers happier. And so they started paying bonuses. In fact, the Uber CEO set aside $250 million to pay signing bonuses for drivers. But even that wasn't good enough. And so the woman who, and it's a woman, by the way, a C-suite job who oversees all of the drivers, she said to the all the rest of the C-suite, you guys ought to get behind the wheel and experience what they're experiencing, and maybe you can come up with some answers for them. And so the Uber CEO started driving. He's done 100 trips, both driving people and picking up orders for Uber Eats, and he immediately got, in a way that he had never got before, all the problems that Uber drivers have, and he started coming up with fixes for all of them, which is really interesting.
Was there one revelation that stands out in your recollection of the article?
There's a couple of things that I think are worth mentioning. One continual problem that Uber drivers have complained about is that, and they do it for Uber Eats or for Uber pickups, that when they're in the middle of driving something, if they accept their next ride, all the information about the current ride or the current delivery goes away. So they can't find where they're going easily. And he realized that the minute it happened to him, that he accepted his next trip while still finishing up the current trip,
right,
which is very common. And suddenly it was like, oh my gosh, where am I going? So they made that a whole lot easier. And that was really a big, kind of a big thing.
Isn't it amazing that something as obvious or simple as that was oblivious to the people that had control over that?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's been a lot of complaints from the people who do Uber Eats, right? They're picking up and delivering food, that people were doing something called tip baiting. Tip baiting, where they promise you, you know, John, you bring me my Uber Eats, I'm going to give you $25, and then they reduce the tip to like $2.50. So you take the order thinking you're going to get a big tip, and then you don't. And they realized, you know, if you just eliminate the ability to reduce tips, then overall tips, they did that to test and see, and then they realized the tips overall were reduced, so they didn't want to do that. They're still trying to work out the exact algorithm so that people are discouraged from tip baiting, and the people who are doing the deliveries get a fairer shake. So it, until you actually walk the mile or drive the mile in someone's shoes, you never really know.
We're talking to Elise Glink on the Wintrust Business Lunch. She's that lady from, well, Sunday mornings with Tom Fortino on WGN. And you guys are talking about a particular query from one of your listeners, right, Elise?
Yeah, we are, John. It's interesting. We, you know, get a lot of emails and texts now, which is great. You know, John and I have been doing the show almost 2 years. And people are really concerned about how do they balance these kinds of issues as they're heading into retirement, this issue between, you know, when do I, you know, take all that money I put away in my 401k and how do I turn that into income to replace the income I'm giving up by retiring? And what do I do about the big expenses in my life, like paying down your mortgage? You know, there are more seniors who have taken out mortgages than at any point in time in history. And even though a lot of them are going into, say, their golden years with a 2.5% loan, some people actually are still paying 3, 4, or 5%. Very few, but they are. And they're still trying to decide, do I even want to have a mortgage payment? So this listener who wrote in is trying to decide whether to take his 401k money and pay down his mortgage or make one big lump sum. And then you can actually ask the mortgage company to reset your mortgage. And that can generate a lower payment for you. One time, they do this for you. Lower mortgage payment ongoing, and you probably cut the years, you know, a bunch of years off your loan. But how do you want to handle that and how do you want to balance these things is really, really important. The other thing that we get once in a while is somebody who's got a really low mortgage, but it's time for them to make a change. And they're looking at today's mortgage rates, which actually today I'm looking at it. If you've got great credit, your 30-year loan is going to be 6.3%. And if you've got the average of a 700, your loan is going to be about 6.8%. That's a far cry above where we were a couple of years ago. And so they're worried that they're going to take on this new big expense with a smaller home because that home costs more, or should they just stay with, you know, where they are and what they're doing? And so these are the kinds of things we're wrestling with.
I'm just thinking if you're paying 2.5 or 3% on your mortgage, but you can lock in 4%, you would advise them to not buy out the mortgage, right?
I don't think that you should. Now, if you've got $10 million in your account, you're one of those people, and you've got a mortgage of $100,000, oh, yeah, cash out, clear out the mortgage. Why do you need it? You know, you have plenty of money. When it's tougher when you only have maybe $700,000 or $800,000 saved, and your mortgage is $200,000 to $300,000, right? So you're taking, let's say, $750,000, and you're going to cash out $300,000 of it, that's only going to leave you with $400,000 or $500,000 in cash for your whole retirement.
Right.
I'm not sure that's a smart move, John, if your interest rate is at 2 or 2.5%. And right now, you can put some money away in a CD and get 5%, right? You've got to sort of look at all the different pieces of it. And this is what Tom and I wrestle with, you know, on behalf of our listeners is, where are you in that spectrum, and what other expenses do you have? And do you have senior parents? You might be 60, but you might have parents who are like 85, and you know you need to take care of them and help them. Maybe you don't want to give up all your cash today. So there's a lot that goes into these questions.
Yeah. And most people take the standard deduction, right? I'm just thinking about mortgage interest, which you could still deduct, correct?
You can, but you're limited to it. And so, of course, we're coming up to tax time. I hope everybody's got their, you know, tax returns. I've got mine sitting on my desk waiting to look at. You know, for most people, they're going to take the standard deduction, which this year is running around, I don't know exactly what it is, like $24,000 or $25,000 for a married couple filing jointly. And you're limited anyway, you know, because of the state and local taxes, SALT deduction, that limits you to, I think it's $10,000. It doesn't pay for 90%+ of people to itemize on their taxes, which means you can't write off your mortgage interest anyway.
I remember spending all year long such... I don't know, we'd have a drawer, an envelope, but Brenda would always be putting in every charitable deduction we made. And then at the end of the year, I'd have this stack of stuff. And then you total it all up and hope that, you know, you could add that to your deductions on your income taxes. We don't seem to do that so much anymore. The real funny thing was you'd drop a bunch of clothes and books and appliances or whatever off at the Salvation Army or United Way or whatever. And then they'd give you a receipt and they'd say, well, you just go ahead and fill that out. So you would, you know, you could put down any number you wanted And then hopefully that's a fair and just number. And if you get audited, I guess you'd have to justify it. But you remember that drill, right?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. And keeping track of every single thing, and you had to prove what it was worth, and then you got to take 20%. The whole thing was crazy. This year, I just looked it up while we were talking, the standard deduction is $12,950 for single filers, $25,900 for joint filers, and $19,400 for those filing as heads of household. Now, if you're 65 or older, I believe your standard deduction increases by $1,700 if you file as single or head of household. So, and there's another increase as well if you or your spouse, if you're filing jointly and one of you is 65 or older, your standard deduction increases a little bit. So there certainly is, you know, a really generous deduction for the amount that you're actually earning. And so it allows us to eliminate all that other stuff.
Yeah, that's why most folks don't have to even worry about that anymore. Well, I'm, you know, Terry Savage does a lot of this, but we kind of do it on the fly when she joins us on Wednesdays. I like the idea that people could write to you, say, okay, here's my situation. What do you guys think? And it sounds like that's what you're going to do Sunday. If somebody else has a scenario, can they write to you? And could would you consider them as well?
Absolutely. You can send me.
How do I do that?
You can, well, I'll just tell you, John, you can send me an email at questions@thinklink.com, T-H-I-N-K-G-L-I-N-K, or just go to the website. You can, there's a button up there that says Ask Elise, and you can just ask me a question, and we will then listen on Sunday mornings for the answer.
Thinklink.com. What a good idea. So what's your deal? Write to questions@thinklink.com or just click on thinklink.com.
That's
okay,
right.
Elise, really interesting stuff. We'll be listening on Sunday.
Sounds good. Happy weekend, John.
We're talking now to the vice chairman of Savills, Robert Sevum, joins us. We're talking about the commercial real estate market in Chicago, I guess downtown mostly, huh? Robert, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
What does your firm do? What's your niche in the market?
So we represent users of real estate. On the commercial side, so that could mean users of office space all the way through those who use industrial real estate and various spectrums of need.
Chicago area, or are you national in your interest?
We are, in fact, an international firm. In North America, we have over 40 offices, and so we work on a national basis and an international basis coming outside of Chicago.
Describe for me the commercial real estate sector in Chicago right now.
Well, right now it's a very interesting time. We're seeing a lot of activity, but it is bifurcated. So what we're seeing are a number of companies who are on one hand rethinking the purpose of their needs, and they're looking to possibly upgrade and enjoy a flight to experience in their environment and really think about how they can really attract and retain the best possible talent for their workforce. And they're looking at it in a very forward-thinking manner. Mm-hmm. And then what we have is another segment of the office-using or even the industrial-using population that are looking at perhaps a little bit more of a cost mitigation program depending on where their business is and how they've fared over the past years, and they're trying to be thoughtful around spend. And so some of those companies are thinking about short-term decisions with the hope that going forward they'll have the platform to make really thoughtful long-term decisions that might require some more investment.
So some of them are figuring out how to manage space in a hybrid world, and some of them are saying, let's up the ante, let's make this a fabulous place to come downtown to, but that might mean an investment, it might mean a commitment. Is that true?
That is true. That is true. They are looking at it that way, and at the end of the day, what it really comes down to is human capital, because what makes companies work really well is the quality of the people, the culture of the company, and how you can use your real estate to amplify the ability for those workers to be extremely powerful. And right now we're in this hybrid mode. So it's a transitional period. There's some experimentation, but there's also some very effective decisions that have been made to really up the ante on the space.
Well, that's been my observation downtown, that the spaces, some of them are much improved, and some of the new things going in are dreamy. It's the place you always wanted to work in. And then there's also empty office space. You said bifurcated. That sounds bifurcated, doesn't it?
It is bifurcated. It is a bit of a tale of two cities within one city, right? So what you have is you have a segment of buildings where owners have had the financial capacity to invest in those buildings, or if it's a new building, obviously, and the amenities and the infrastructure in those buildings are highly advanced and they're very appealing to the workforce. And then, unfortunately, there's some buildings that are more vintage in nature whose owners or, current oversight has not had the ability or can't underwrite the ability to be able to reinvest or invest or reposition those buildings so that they are as appealing as they could be. And it's just a marketplace right now where some of those investments are not able to be made. And so you see this chasm that grows between these dreamy buildings, as you put it, and then some of these other buildings that that are going to have to go through a little bit of pain before the market cycle hopefully turns and allows them to do what we all hope them to do.
Yeah, sounds like another curve, a K-shaped curve or K-shaped graph. What's the occupancy rate downtown?
Well, the occupancy rate hovers around 50%, depending on the building. But on average, that's where we're seeing it. You know, certainly in the middle of the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays, and depending on the quality and the class of buildings, you'll see in excess of that, sometimes 60 or 70%. But then you'll have other buildings where you'll see a number that is lower. But it is a great improvement from what we've seen, you know, last year. And we have to keep hoping that people understand that the benefit of working together and being in person and collaborating is generally more powerful than trying to do things alone. So that number, we hope, will augment. I think everyone has to work together and do that.
Is it going to go back to where we were? Or do you think that this office space needs to be reimagined? It needs to be commercial. It needs to be condo. It needs to be, I don't know what, but it's not, we're not going to get back to the 100% that we want, 100% of what we once were.
I think the idea of live, work, play has always been around. I think what COVID did is it accelerated the recognition that that is where things are at. And so to the extent that people look at their journey to the office and how they use their time during a day as a component of live, work, play, where you've got amenities and you have access to different things that allow you to feel happy in your productivity, is going to be something we have to recognize is here. And so the question of going back to where we were, you know, if you look at statistics, we were never a full 100% occupancy Monday through Friday environment. You know, people took time off on Fridays, and there was more and more leniency towards people getting personal things done, perhaps during any given day. It's all about productivity. So what we're seeing now is how do you manage that reality in an environment where coming into your work area is considered to be, you know, interesting and appealing for the worker, because the things that you may have around you and the options that allow you to feel happy as you're being productive have increased. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of these buildings and a lot of these new neighborhoods that are really thinking about all of these elements of live, work, play in one area in the downtown market. So it's fascinating.
I'm thinking of West Loop, but tell me as specifically as you can what areas are hot and attractive and what areas are more challenged.
I think if you think of those components I mentioned in the live, work, play concept and paradigm, certainly the West Loop, Fulton Market, River North, you know, they really accentuate a lot of those factors where you've got great residential, great office, great entertainment, some outdoor space as well. You know, obviously, if you look at on the other side, you know, in the East Loop, overlooking Millennium Park, you've got obviously wonderful experiences and views and environment. I think some of the more challenged areas are probably the Central Loop in certain areas of the Central Loop right now.
Yeah.
Because they don't really encompass all of those aspects that we seek today. Doesn't mean it can't change, and it doesn't mean it can't evolve over time. But right now, I think that's probably the most challenged of those submarkets.
You're describing the financial district right there. Is that what you're talking about?
Correct. Correct.
It's funny because that's not that far from the East Loop, you know. I mean, granted, you don't have the view and maybe it's a longer walk to a restaurant or Millennium Park, but we're not talking about the other side of town. We're talking about 10 blocks, 5 blocks, depending on where you're located.
You're absolutely right. We're not talking about a long way away. I think at the end of the day, it depends on where you may be in your space. So if you're lower down in a building, for example, As beautiful as some of those buildings are in the central loop, what you tend to experience is a lack of light and air. And if you move over to either parts of the west loop or parts of the east loop, tend to find perhaps a little more spaciousness in between either buildings or some of the areas that you would frequent. And so what needs to happen is just an understanding that that part of the market will need to think about some ideas on revitalization and figuring out how to be very crafty around creating areas and experiences that are a little bit harder to think of there. But we hope that there's a lot of great thought leadership, brain power, and capital that hopefully gets deployed and revitalizes the central loop, because it's a great part of town. It just needs to be the bridge that we want it to be between the east loop and the west loop and Fulton and River North, which are already, you know, very well activated.
We're tapping some brain power here. Robert Sevim, the vice chairman at Savills, Savills.com, Savills. Robert, it's really interesting. Let's connect again. I appreciate your looking into this, and thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have a great weekend.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news now with Dave Schwann.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. We added over 250,000 jobs to the U.S. economy last month. The Labor Department says 236,000 jobs were added in March. Unemployment fell to 3.5%. The job numbers are down, though, from the 326,000 jobs added in February. We'll see how the markets react to this news next week. U.S. markets are closed today in observance of Good Friday. Honda is recalling over 560,000 older model crossover SUVs sold in cold weather states, which means us. The Japanese carmaker says an accumulation of road salt can cause part of the vehicle's suspension to corrode and possibly detach. Honda says the recalled vehicles are model year 2007 to 2011 CRVs. Owner notification letters will be mailed next month. That's your Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Dave Schwann.
Business of Food and Steve Alexander.
Yes, and let's lay down a beat as I thank the Chevy Silverado HD for being our sponsor today. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Dusting off an oldie from Eddie Cochran today to help us talk about
jelly bean, jelly bean.
Yeah, this is jelly bean season for Chicago's very own Brock's Candy Company, which did not invent jelly beans, but it's been making them for a long time.
For the past 114 years.
That's Lauren Pezza, who I will call the jelly bean queen for my purposes today, but officially she is
director of Brock's and seasonal marketing at Ferrara Candy Company.
Brock's makes a lot of jelly beans.
More than 2.5 billion jelly beans in a given Easter season,
which begins the day after Valentine's Day and goes through Easter Sunday. Brock's beginnings were in 1904 when German immigrant Emil J. Brock got into the candy business.
He threw down $1,000 to open up Brock's Palace of Sweets, which was located at the time of North Avenue and Town Street, where he sold taffy and caramels and ice cream and a bunch of other fun sweets.
And the rest is, well, you know. So how are jelly beans made? The main ingredients are
cooking starch, sugar, water, and corn syrup.
And they go through some cooking and cooling and put into molds to shape the centers, and then they go into tumblers.
We remove them from these tumbler machines, and we lay them out to dry.
And then they get polished with a confectioner's glaze, more sugar, and off they go into packages and eventually into your mouth. And because of the way they're made,
we say that Brock's jelly beans are similar to snowflakes and that they're, no two are exactly identical.
There are different sizes, though, and all kinds of flavors, including a new group this year called Desserts of the World. But the very first flavors made are still among the most popular.
Cherry, orange, pineapple, lime, lemon, grape, and then licorice.
There we go. A little of Chicago's jelly bean history on this biggest jelly bean weekend of the year. Go ahead, grab a handful. We won't tell your dentist. Actually, your dentist may thank you. From the farm to your belly, today is National Coffee Cake Day. It's also National Beer Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Let's talk to Tony Carman, the president and director at Expo Chicago. Boy, they got a big doings going on starting Monday. Tony, thanks for joining us. You're on WGN. How are you?
Thank you, John. Really well. It's great to be ready to welcome the world to our great city next week.
Navy Pier is a terrific space. It's the best view of the city when you head out, even just a little bit. The weather's going to be fantastic next week. And you've got an expo with how many exhibitors? 150 or so?
Actually, it's 170 international art galleries from 36 countries, 90 international cities, and probably over 3,000 works of artwork that will be available for sale, anywhere from $500 up to several million. So you can choose.
Is this something you've done every year? Did you have to take a pause? Catch me up on this.
Yes, we did. We launched Expo Chicago in 2012, and then our last fair pre-pandemic was 2019. So unfortunately, we had to sit out for a little over 2 years. We reemerged in a new slot in April of 2022. And so this is a renewal, and it's—I have to say—it's nice to have the pandemic in our rearview mirror. We had a great return last year, but I'm anticipating, you know, a large number of visitors and patrons and collectors and curators from around the world to visit and join.
And some guest speakers, including Chance the Rapper. Is Chance going to be there?
He will, actually. We worked last year with Chance presenting some artwork that he had commissioned for one of his studio releases. So he is a great friend of the fair. He's a great artist in his own right. And he's going to be doing a discussion with another internationally renowned artist, Hank Willis Thomas, and then probably a few other surprises. You know, we look forward to working with him again.
What medium does he work in? Is he a painter, a sculptor? What does he do?
Oh, actually, I was mentioning he purely is a musician, but he works closely with visual artists to align with many of his album releases. And he's also very, very collaborative in so many different mediums.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, he's a community activist. He's a judge on TV now, and he's Chicago's own. Are there artworks or artists, though, that you're excited about? Could you describe just a little of what I'll see when I get out there?
Yeah, I mean, you'll experience, like I said, probably over 3,000 works of art, from two-dimensional paintings to sculpture to video work. There'll be artwork from, as I mentioned, numerous galleries from around the world. I have a lot of galleries coming in from South America and South Africa, which is really extraordinary. And so a patron will be able to really engage and survey what is happening in the contemporary art world from around the world. It's like walking into a museum where you can actually acquire the artwork. And I think that's the most important part of this. You'll be able to, you know, engage artwork and, you know, decide if you like it or provoked by it. But more importantly, make sure that you can bring it home and live with it, I hope.
So I'll pay a fee at the door, will I, and then cruise the galleries? Is that how it works?
That's exactly it. We take all of the festival hall at Navy Pier. One price is an entry to not just the extraordinary array of galleries, but also public talks, discussion, the one that you mentioned with Chance and Hank Willis Thomas, and many others. There's a lot of activities for everyone to enjoy. From art enthusiasts to, yeah, you know, seasoned collectors.
ExpoChicago.com for information. It starts on Monday and runs for, what did I see, 10 days? Is that right?
Actually, it runs until Sunday. We created a what's called Expo Art Week, which starts next Monday, aligning with lots of events happening in the city. But Expo Chicago opens April 13th and runs till Sunday the 16th.
ExpoChicago.com. Okay, good luck, good weather. Have a great time.
Thank you, John. See you out here.